Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, August 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Prestwick Chase, offering maintenance-free housing options for 55-plus active adults with one- and two-bedroom apartments at cottages in historic Saratoga Springs. 518-584-7766 to schedule tours. Joining us this afternoon to talk about sleep disorders is Dr. Boris Medarov, Medical Director of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. He'll talk about diagnosing sleep disorders and the state-of-the-art treatments. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Boris Medarov and your sleepy calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the Sleep Research Society recommend that adults aged 18 to 60 sleep at least 7 hours a night. For many of us, yeah, it would be a pretty good trick. In the studio this afternoon to discuss sleep disorders, the diagnoses, and treatment is Dr. Boris Medarov. Dr. Medarov is a pulmonary and critical care physician and the medical director of Albany Med's Sleep Clinic, where he evaluates patients with sleep complaints and diagnoses and treats sleep disorders. If you have a question, get in now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Boris Medarov, welcome back. It's been a while.
Hello, Ray. It's always a pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
How much sleep do you get a night?
I aim for 8 hours, and it's probably enough for me.
True or false? Myth or fact? As one ages, one needs less sleep per night.
Yes or no. It's a fact that we sleep less. It's not necessarily that we need less sleep, but unfortunately the quality of our sleep suffers and we sleep less. Not necessarily the same as needing less sleep, though.
Okay, so we still need the same amount, we just don't succeed.
Arguably, yes.
Is that why we get old and die?
Part of it, yeah.
Yeah, you think so? Just before we get rolling with the calls and such and talk about CPAPs and everything else that we talk about when you're on, let's talk a little about what happens to us, our brain, our bodies during REM sleep. What goes on there?
It's an excellent question, and there is no straightforward answer that everybody agrees on. REM sleep is deep sleep, and in many ways the body is at its lowest level. For example, the musculature is almost completely paralyzed during REM sleep. On the other hand, there is evidence that there is a lot of brain activity going on during REM sleep. As your listeners probably know, this is the time when we believe we dream. What is the function of the REM sleep remains a subject of a lot of controversy. There is a lot of theories, including that we may be reliving some of our experiences, that we rehash and reprocess the information that we collect during the day and we store it deeper into our brain. But to be honest, as of now, nobody has a very clear answer why we have such a peculiar, specific type of sleep that occupies about 25% of all our sleep.
Do we only dream in REM sleep, or are there other cycles that we will also dream in?
Another excellent question, and it's not an easy thing to determine, as you can imagine, because there is no easy loopback mechanism to tell us when somebody is dreaming, or when we know if they are dreaming, they don't have the option to tell us they are. So we do believe, based on some correlation, that mostly during REM is when we dream, but it may not be a very strict 100%.
Interesting.
Fact, yeah.
All right, before we get to the calls, take us quickly through a cycle where I go to sleep, then what happens? Is there a progression, or can you hit any particular sleep cycle at any time, first, second, third, whatever?
So normally there is a progression. There is several stages of sleep. There is the REM sleep or R type of sleep and the non-REM sleep. So normally one would get into the most superficial type of sleep, which is the non-REM or slow wave sleep. Actually, I take this back. We don't really call it slow wave these days. Stage one of non-REM sleep. This is the lightest and the most superficial type of sleep. Then we progress into stage two, and after that, stage three. As we progress through those three stages, the EEG activity or the waves in our brain that we detect during the electroencephalography become slower and slower, and the waves become larger and larger, and it turns into
the brain waves become larger and larger. The sign
correct.
Of
the amplitude, the size.
Interesting.
And it turns into what we call slow wave sleep. So it's a slow transition, and we see more of that in kids. So kids have a lot of slow wave sleep. We believe this is one of the most restorative, the deepest part of the non-REM sleep.
Interesting. But REM is still more restorative?
So REM is also considered restorative, probably in a different way. We know it's not essential. So for
We've had a little technical gaffe here. We'll just put this person on hold. Apologize. Sometimes the machine has a mind of its own. Pray continue.
So REM is believed to be a deep sleep in many ways, but it's also, as I said, a stage of the sleep when our brain is quite active. So it may be too simplistic to simply group the types of sleep into deep and non-deep, but it is different than the deep non-REM sleep, which is stage three, stage two sleep.
You know, we talk about catnaps, or we talk about pulling, if you're driving a long distance, pulling over, getting 20 minutes of sleep. If one is sleep deprived, say has been up for 24 hours, and then you take a nap, are you immediately jumping to that most restorative part of sleep, or is it, again, a random crapshoot?
Well, the more sleep deprived you are, the quicker you're going to get into deep sleep, and you may get right into REM sleep as well. I was mentioning that we go from awake to stage one, two, three, non-REM sleep, and then we normally get into REM sleep. So usually the latency of REM sleep, the amount of time that passes between we fall asleep and we get into REM sleep is usually more than an hour, hour and a half to 2 hours. If you are sleep deprived, and it may be an interesting fact to your listeners, in certain conditions such as narcolepsy, we may actually get right into REM sleep, or the REM latency, which is normally more than an hour, may be very short.
Dr. Boris Medaroff is our guest today. It's Sleep and Sleep Medicine on the program, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question, let's grab an email here, and then we'll take a break and then hit the phones. This one's from Elizabeth. Subject heading, sleep deprivation. I've heard that electrical current running through our homes can disrupt our sleep. Is this possible?
Is it possible? I don't know if it's possible. There is no good evidence that that is the case. That applies to direct current, alternating current. There is really no good scientific evidence. I would call it more of a myth than a scientific fact.
You know, you mentioned that science is not exactly sure what's going on in the brain when REM sleep is happening. What other mysteries are there with these sleep cycles that people in your line of work are trying to figure out?
A lot. We can start out with the mere fact that it's not a well-established fact or consensus why we sleep. There are a lot of theories why we sleep to begin with. Considering the circadian rhythm of our sleep, it probably has something to do with the day-night cycle. So one theory is that most animals, or at least high-order biological entities, whether it's mammals or birds, we sleep because at night we can't really see, and being awake would be a waste of energy.
Interesting.
So yeah, one of the prominent theories why we sleep is basically energy preservation. Another theory is that we process the information during the day and we store it. And I mentioned that some of the theories regarding REM sleep, it may serve some of those functions. So right there from the get-go, there is a big controversy in sleep medicine, why we sleep.
Interesting. You know, you mentioned the circadian rhythms, and we know that blind people have issues with this. Is there research being done in, say, Antarctica or the North Pole, where there is 24 hours of sun or 24 hours of dark for long periods of time, and the effect on sleep cycles?
So there is a good body of evidence how that works. Probably not as much on Antarctica and those places, because the 24-hour circadian cycle is still the same, even though the day is shorter and the night is longer, obviously. But the frequency of the cycle is still 24 hours. However, there have been many cases, including specifically trials or research, when people were enclosed in caves with zero cues from the outside world when it's day and night. Blind people are also another example of that. So there is a good a number of studies and research how those people handle it. And we do know that we do need the outside guidance to maintain our cycle. If somebody is left without the outside cues regarding day and night, our cycle tends to run longer. So it's more than 24 hours if we are left on our own faculties in terms of the cycle within our brain. So there are certain genes that get transcribed in the brain that regulate our cycle, but that process requires cues from the outside world to maintain it.
Can you simulate it with artificial light, full spectrum halogen, for instance?
Yes, you can. Any light being strong enough can maintain that, and it's a good idea to do it if somebody is not exposed to the regular outside light.
Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest today at Sleep and Sleep Medicine. We'll get to your calls in a moment. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll be back. You know, I don't want to beat a dead horse because the horse is still alive at this point, but I have a live event coming up August 26th at the Hart Clewitt Museum in Troy. It's going to be cool. Kathy Sheehan, who is the Rensselaer County historian and the director of the Hart Clewitt, will be there. The folks from Stair Galleries will be there. You will come and bring your antiques, and the folks at Stair Galleries will give you a verbal appraisal. It's kind of a road show that we can't call it that thing, that antique show that's on the road, because then we'll get sued. But it's that sort of idea. So if you want to find out more, go to our website, WAMC.org. Click on WAMC on the Road. This event is August 26th, and we hope to see everybody there. The number here on this program is 800-348-2551. Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest today. It's Sleep and Sleep Medicine. And let's begin in Fishkill. Nate, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Am I coming in loud and clear?
10-4, good buddy.
All righty. My question regards sleep apnea. I'm curious if there are a series of different causes for sleep apnea, and if there is a treatment option besides the electric-driven controlled atmospheric pressure mask.
So there are different types of sleep apnea. The common type of sleep apnea that we usually talk about is what we call obstructive sleep apnea. It's a mechanical issue related to the full or partial collapse of the airway during sleep that interferes with the airflow and therefore can cause unrefreshing sleep and increase the level of inflammation and the cardiovascular risk. With regards to treatment, when we talk about obstructive sleep apnea, CPAP remains the mainstay, but there are other treatments. So there are surgical procedures that can be done to alleviate the crowdiness of the airway, as we call it. There's the classic procedures that involve trimming the airway, removing the tonsils if they are still present, part of the soft palate. There is a relatively newer procedure that a lot of people are aware of. It's been advertised quite a bit lately. The CPAP commercials. That is the Inspire system. It's a small pacemaker-like device that can be implanted under the skin, and it paces one of the nerves underneath the chin, the hypoglossal nerve. There is also oral appliances that can be made, custom-made, typically by dental professionals in relatively mild cases. In summary, those are more or less the options, surgery, CPAP, and the Inspire system.
Nate.
Okay, thank you. Is there any evidence to support the use of different kinds of pillows to position the spine and the airway so it's not obstructed?
The short answer is no. There is good evidence that sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, is worse when you're on your back. That's pretty much a fact in everybody. That's due to some anatomical properties of our airway. Basically, anything that would prevent you from sleeping on your back would make sleep apnea better. Mm. It will not necessarily completely eliminate it. And if a pillow or any kind of a setup prevents you from being on your back, mostly may help, but it's never sufficient treatment by itself.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Sonia writes in, is losing weight always a benefit to reducing snoring?
It is always beneficial in reducing snoring and sleep apnea, for that matter. Those two things are related. At least the majority of the cases, there may be some unusual anatomical cases when the weight is not a factor, but I would say 99% of the cases, it will be beneficial. That's not to say, however, that it will be sufficient. Making it better is one thing. Completely sufficiently treating it is a different question.
Interesting. All right, this email from Don, and then we'll go back to the phones. I have a tendency to wake up at exactly the same time every night for decades, 3:36 a.m., says Dawn. This has happened no matter where I sleep, hotels, whatever. I've checked my bedroom. There's no clock or electrical item that clicks at that time, which might wake me up. This has happened even when I moved to a new house. Have you ever heard of such a thing or what might explain it? For a long time, I thought it was because my mother died at that time, but she passed away over 45 years ago, and that's from Dawn in Slingerlands.
So it's an interesting question. As early morning awakenings can be a sign of stress and depression, which is not to say that it's always the case and certainly not necessarily the case with you. But this is something to keep in mind. Falling asleep easily but difficulties maintaining sleep is called maintenance insomnia. Now, with regards to the exact same time of the night to the minute, it would be difficult for me to place that. But I would say if you have difficulties maintaining your sleep towards the early morning hours, make sure you're not depressed. And the other possibility is some people are just wired that way, and maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock is the normal time for you to get up.
Okay. I mean, that's a pretty large coincidence if her mom died at that exact time, even if it was 45 years ago. Now, I happen to know someone else who had the same thing. His father died at a certain point every morning, and he woke up every morning for decades at that time. Is it just trauma-induced?
It may be. That brings me back to my original point that depression and stress may be in the background of similar symptoms. Even if it has been decades, a major trauma like this stays with us.
Let's go back to our phones with Dr. Boris Medarov from Albany Med. We'll go to Schenectady. Jack, you're on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about the use risks of melatonin, if you recommend, if you don't recommend, how to use it towards like getting a better sleep cycle. And I'm going to sign off from here. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call.
So melatonin is a natural hormone that's secreted by the brain by a specific structure that's called the pineal gland in the brain. It is a natural substance, and there is no significant risk to taking it. Having said that, it is not regulated by the FDA exactly because it's a natural substance and technically is classified as a nutritional supplement. It can be used for two purposes. One is to promote sleep, for which purpose it's a relatively mild hypnotic. If somebody suffers of insomnia, difficulties falling asleep, if melatonin works, it's an excellent option. The problem is most of the time it would not do the job. If you want to use it for that purpose, I would say somewhere between 2 and 5 milligrams an hour before the desired time of a bedtime is when you should take it. The other use, and this is the natural purpose of melatonin, it's a hormone that regulates the circadian rhythm of the body. The pineal gland, the part of the brain that secretes it, is connected to our eyes through neural pathways. And the cues of the outside world that I was talking about earlier that regulate our circadian rhythm do that through the eyes and then through the secretion of this hormone. So it can be used to maintain or regulate somebody's circadian rhythm, especially in people who have the tendency to fall asleep too late, typical for teenagers. We call this delayed sleep phase syndrome. And also people who have shift work and they don't always work at the same time. So you can take it to kind of bring forward your night time, so to speak. It's very safe. There isn't significant, there is no evidence of significant side effects. The major downside, as I mentioned, is it may not work.
Number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Boris Medarov from Albany Med, let's go back to the phones. And John is in Del Mar. John, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, it sounds like you're on the 215 to Chattanooga, but yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Well, I sleep at least 10 hours a day and sometimes take a nap in the afternoon. Is there anything wrong with me?
That sounds lovely. That sounds great.
So, some people do need more sleep than others. This magical number of 7 or 8 hours is not necessarily something that applies to everybody. Having said that, 10 hours a night plus some naps is something that falls outside of what we would typically see. If that's what you experience, I would certainly at least undergo a sleep study to see what may be going on. Sleep apnea that we've been talking about, by far one of the most common sleep disorders, can absolutely result in long sleep and sleepiness despite that, by the virtue that even though you sleep a lot, the quality of the sleep you get may not be good. So I would get myself tested.
All right, John, thanks a lot for the call. It's 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Chrissy from Niskayuna writes, within the last year, my 76-year-old father-in-law started showing symptoms of night terrors. He'll sometimes scream in his sleep, swing his arms as if he's fighting something. He doesn't report any memory of what he's dreaming about. What could be causing this onset, and is there anything we can do to try to stop it?
So I would consider a syndrome or condition that's called REM behavior syndrome. This is not the usual night terrors that we see in young kids. At his age, night terrors, slow wave parasomnias, as we call those, is almost unheard of, especially if it's a new onset. REM behavior disorder is a peculiar condition that results in lack of muscle paralysis during REM sleep, which is normally what we see. And one of the reasons why our muscles are paralyzed during REM sleep is to prevent us from acting out our dreams. Relatively common or more common in elderly men, what you're describing based on his age and gender would make me think that REM behavior disorder is by far the most common issue here. One thing that one needs to keep in mind that REM behavior disorder may be a sign of early Parkinson's disease or Parkinson-related conditions. Let me just make sure that I don't led you to believe that your father has Parkinson's. This is just a risk factor that needs to be kept in mind. I would have him seen by a sleep specialist, potentially tested. There is treatment for that, by the way, yes.
Dr. Boris Medarov's our guest. All right, here's an email that might dovetail with that one. John writes in, I have a few times in the past woken up and been completely paralyzed for a few seconds without being able to even breathe. The first time it was absolutely terrifying, but the next time I was more prepared. Why does this happen? Does it signify anything? It hasn't happened for a few years now, but I always think about it. Sleep paralysis.
Sleep paralysis. This is called sleep paralysis, and in many cases may be a relatively benign phenomenon that doesn't carry any significance besides the fact it can indeed be scary as you've experienced that yourself. Having said that, it's also a typical symptom of narcolepsy. If there are any symptoms suggestive of narcolepsy, which is a hypersomnia syndrome, meaning people feel excessively sleepy during the day despite sufficient number of hours of sleep, sleep paralysis could be a sign of narcolepsy. So if you're sleepy, if you think there are other issues that bother you, if you see hallucinations sometimes when you're drowsy, that may be a sign of narcolepsy. But once again, sleep paralysis could be a benign phenomenon that has no significance.
Number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab a call or two before the next break. And Chris is in Nassau. Chris, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to find out if taking an edible for sleep is detrimental to one's health.
So the short answer is...
Is it THC you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
The short answer is probably not. There is a lot of controversy surrounding THC and marijuana, similar substances. The evidence behind any potential harmful effect of that substance remains quite controversial. If you ask me for my personal opinion based on what I've seen, what I know, without necessarily claiming this is standing on very firm scientific evidence, I would not worry too much about any long-term negative consequences as long as it helps. And as long as somebody only uses it occasionally.
Chris.
Okay, that's good to know. Unfortunately, I haven't been using it occasionally, but I will try. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. All right, here's another side of that. Jack and Troy writes, I've heard that small blood alcohol levels can adversely affect REM sleep. What is this effect, and how does it vary by the amount of alcohol consumed?
So alcohol affects sleep in a negative way in general. It certainly reduces the amount of REM sleep and also results in a non-restorative sleep. So what usually happens is the sedative effect of the alcohol in large enough or high enough levels may put you to sleep easily. Most people have had experience that. But as soon as the level starts tapering off in the blood, in the serum, our sleep becomes very poor. And everybody who, again, has been intoxicated and remembers those nights when they passed out but then started waking up in the middle of the night know that. So bottom line is the alcohol interferes with the architecture of our sleep. It decreases the amount of REM sleep or when the levels are high, and may lead to rebound of REM sleep towards the early morning hours. In summary, not a good sleeping aid. I would never recommend using alcohol for this purpose. It will backfire even if on the surface sounds like a good idea in the beginning.
Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest. One more call before the next break, 800-348-2551. And to Madam Morris we go. Jim, you're on.
What are the chances of a sinus infection progressing to pneumonia?
Sinus infection progressing to pneumonia.
In general, or in relationship to something like CPAP used for the treatment of sleep apnea?
Either.
Either. Okay.
Either. Well, it's a loaded question, and I don't know if I can answer it in 20 seconds. So sinusitis, sinus infection is something that almost universally happens if you have a sinus problem with regards to the drainage. Normal sinuses, so let's say somebody doesn't have allergies or some other issue that results in congestion, when they drain well, they will never get infected. Now, if you do get an infection because of poor drainage or congested sinuses, this is not something that would normally lead to further infections such as pneumonia. In some rare, unusual case, some very malignant infection or virulent infection takes place in the sinuses, potentially could lead to overwhelming infection in the whole body called sepsis. But in general, for the garden variety sinus infection that we normally talk about, it's not something that would progress to pneumonia.
Jim, thanks for the call. Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest. 800-348-2551 is our number. Sleep disorders today. We'll be back. Blues for Butterball. There's Frank West and the group here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's sleep and sleep medicine today with Dr. Boris Medarov. Let's grab a couple of emails here before we jump back to the phones. Doreen writes in, any experience or comments regarding astral projection and the stage sleep that it can happen in?
Well, the short answer is no. I'm not aware of any scientific evidence that points in that direction.
I love that stuff, though. It's such a cool concept, remote viewing and whatnot. Kyle writes in, is cherry juice a proven sleep aid? Are there any other natural substances?
Approved? No. There is no formal approval process for those over-the-counter remedies. There are over-the-counter options that may or may not work. Melatonin that I mentioned earlier is one of those. It's probably one of the most commonly used sleeping aids. Valeriana root is also something that you can find in a variety of over-the-counter medications. Antihistamines are medications that are used for allergies, such as Benadryl, for example, Allegra. They do have the tendency to put people to sleep, and sometimes are used over-the-counter for that purpose. They may be found as a component of some of the PM brands that, like Tylenol PM, and anything that has PM on it usually has a little bit of antihistamine that makes you more prone to sleep. But those things are not FDA regulated or approved for that purpose.
E writes in, please discuss why some people drive in their sleep when they take Ambien. I've not heard of this.
Some people drive in their sleep. I hope he does not or she doesn't mean actual driving while you're asleep. Now, that would be a problem.
Yeah, that would be a problem.
If they mean dreaming of driving. But so bottom line is Ambien can make you do weird stuff at night. You can get up and start eating and have no recollection of that. Can do some degree of sleepwalking, sleep talking while on Ambien. I sure have not heard of anybody driving like that because let's be real. If you're asleep, even with the best automatic movements, you wouldn't be able to drive.
You know, let's just quickly, and we'll go right to the phones. Sleepwalking. Now, I'm a lot of kids, and I've only seen it happen once to one of my children, and it was freaky. And the kid just came down and walked down to the sliding glass doors and then walked right back and went to bed. What goes on?
So it's a very peculiar but thankfully very benign phenomenon. Virtually all kids experience a little bit of sleepwalking or sleep talking at some phase of their growing up. Why does it happen? I guess our brain is a very complex structure, and when during sleep, small part of the brain is not completely asleep, may result in weird behavior like this. Could indeed be creepy, and in the past, unfortunately, some kids or even adults who had a very prominent cases of the slow wave parasomnias, as we called them, were unfortunately, you know, labeled as demons and whatnot. Thankfully, we know better these days. The important thing to remember is, I need to emphasize this enough, it is a very benign phenomenon. It does not indicate any neurodegenerative process going on. People or kids usually outgrow it. And even if it remains in some degree into adulthood, it's really not a problem. You may need to take some steps to safe-proof your environment and make sure you don't have an open window if you live on the third floor. Don't keep a loaded gun or knife on your nightstand, which is never a good idea. Kind of common sense measures.
Well, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. And Laura's in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Go ahead.
Yes, the glymphatic system takes care of sleep, washing away the debris in the brain. And the lymphatic system does the rest for the rest of the body. But I'm wondering about cortisol levels that are highest in the morning. What system gets rid of the cortisol? Is it the lymphatic system or the glymphatic system, which takes care of the washing away during sleep time?
Okay.
Could you elaborate on that? How does one get rid of the cortisol levels that are so high in the morning and slowly decrease during the day?
So the short answer is it's not the lymphatic system. The glymphatic system is basically the lymphatic system of the brain. The lymphatic system is a system that removes certain substances that are not normally carried or taken away by the blood. And subsequently, the lymph gets into the bloodstream, and whether it's fats from our digestive system or other metabolites from the brain, other places, ultimately all those substances are carried by the lymph into the bloodstream. Now, having said that, it does not really apply to the steroids, the hydrocortisol, the cortisol levels that you were referring to. Those are normal. Cortisol is a normal hormone that's produced by our adrenal glands. It is, we like to call it kind of a stress hormone, and it does peak in the early morning hours. We believe that's in preparation for the stressful event of waking up, so to speak. It is metabolized by the body itself. It's carried in the blood and metabolized off the blood. So it's really not a matter of the lymphatic or glymphatic system taking care of it.
All right, Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to John in Schenectady. John, you're on.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My question was, I'm 61 years old, and I've had COPD for a while. I worked nights for 30 years, and the past year and a half I've been on days. When I was on nights, I got acute problems from the COPD all the time. And when I changed to days, my sleep pattern change seemed to have reduced the amount of times that I have flare-ups of the COPD. You know, I feel a little healthier. Is there a lot of research or any research done on that, that shows the difference between people who sleep all night and people who work all night?
May I ask you if you smoke or if you have smoked in the past?
I smoked for 25 years.
Okay.
Yep.
And the reason I'm asking... Yeah, the reason I'm asking this is because there is COPD, obviously, which is invariably a smoke-related condition at this day and age, at least in the United States. And there is the asthma, which in many ways is similar to COPD, and very often there is an overlap. Now, in the case of asthma, there is a very well established circadian rhythm of the physiological state of the airways. And people who have asthma usually have run into trouble in the early morning hours, so in the middle of the night, quite often. So if there is a component of asthma that does not apply as much to COPD, what I'm describing, but if there is a component of asthma in somebody, potentially the circadian rhythm applies to that state in that way. So if you work mostly at nights, you may run more into problems just because it happens to be nighttime. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, yes.
I'm just saying that the incidence of my getting bronchitis and pneumonia seemed to go down greatly when I was better rested, sleeping at night,
okay,
and up during the day.
Well, that can absolutely be a factor, and a good sleep is important for our whole body functioning. I can't really outline a specific, very well-determined connection between the two outside of good sleep is needed for everything.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Let's go to Rensselaer and Richard. Richard, you're on.
Good afternoon. There's times when I seem to be dreaming before I fall asleep, and I want to know, how does that compare with what you said about REM sleep?
So dreaming before falling asleep, let me see if I understand this correctly. So you're awake, you are aware that you're awake, and you're aware of your environment, but you believe you're dreaming. Is that what you're describing?
And then something happens that's very different than my where I actually am and so forth. A dream, you know, like I'm someplace else, and so forth, and then I wake up and I'm in the chair in my house.
So very very briefly, so we can't really call dreaming unless you're asleep. Having said that, I alluded earlier to narcolepsy, which is a REM intrusion disorder, which means that you may see signs of REM sleep during wakefulness. And seeing vivid images, quote-unquote hallucinating, right before you fall asleep may be a sign of, quote-unquote, dreaming when you're awake. Something to keep in mind. Again, I'm not necessarily saying you have narcolepsy, but potentially that could explain it.
Richard, thank you. And let's go to Colebrook, Connecticut. Jim, you're on.
Hi there. I've been diagnosed with sleep apnea. I have a CPAP machine, but I cannot tolerate it. And I'm just wondering if there's an alternative treatment for folks like us.
If you have given CPAP a good trial and you're fairly confident at this point that this is not for you, you have several options. The Inspire system, which I mentioned earlier, which is a surgical procedure that results in an implanted device that paces your hypoglossal nerve and helps at night, is one option. It works across the spectrum of severity, so even for severe cases, can be considered. And there are oral appliances that are made by dental professionals that usually work in mild cases. We generally don't recommend them for severe cases. But if CPAP is not an option for you, it would be better than not using anything. And last but not least, there are the classic surgical procedures that in selected cases may be helpful. It comes with a lot of considerations that you need to be aware of. I would talk to your sleep provider about that.
Is surgery the last resort usually?
The usual type of the classic surgery, I would say yes. It's somewhat unpredictable. It's aggressive. You remove part of the soft tissues of the throat. There is no going back. You cannot just try it and reverse it.
Jim, thanks a lot. To Pittsfield, John, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a professional musician, and this is going to sound strange, but sometimes when I'm on stage, I actually fall asleep and somehow am able to keep playing. And I'm just curious if you know, someone told me that maybe I had, I forget what it's called, but where you fall asleep just standing up kind of stuff. And I was curious what you thought about that.
Wow.
What instrument do you play, if I may ask?
I play guitar.
Okay.
So, yes, I'm standing up when I'm playing.
So, I mean, the way I imagine that is that you're in a trance, if you will. I don't know if I could use a better word for that. You can't really be fully asleep, standing on the stage and playing guitar, but maybe you're getting into some transitional phase between being completely awake and being completely asleep. And since I'm assuming you've been doing this guitar playing for a long time, you've developed a lot of automatic skills.
Let me just add one more thing. Up until about 15 years ago, I used narcotics, and that would happen to me. And I'm wondering if this is a feedback from back then. You know, like I said, I haven't used in a long time.
Interesting.
But,
probably not. I would say this much. This is not a red flag. It is not something that would make me worry about something going on with you, with your brain or your sleep. You're just a devoted musician, and you continue playing your guitar when you're asleep, so to speak.
Are you getting good reviews for your playing while you're taking a nap, or what?
Oh, yeah, I get standing ovations.
Hey, man, go with the flow. John, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Quickly, Doc, Caroline writes in, I'm a 75-year-old woman who seems to get tired every day around 2 or 3 p.m. If I take a nap, it's usually very deep. Then I can't get back to sleep till around midnight. I usually go to sleep around 10 p.m. If I don't take the nap, I can be tired enough to fall asleep sitting up. Should I give in and take a nap when I'm tired or not?
A very good question, and a lot of people run into this issue. I would say probably the best option for you, if you can stick to it, is to take your nap, but keep it short, no more than 15, 20 minutes. That will give you the necessary boost to go through your day, but it won't be long enough to cause what we call sleep inertia or interfere with your sleep later tonight. In a nutshell, this is probably what I would try doing. It may not be easy to follow through if you normally sleep for an hour and a half. Set up your alarm clock if that's what it takes. Take a short nap and go on with your day.
Well, we are done. Dr. Boris Medarov, thank you so much for being with us once again. Always interesting program when you're here.
Thank you, Ray. It was my pleasure.
Support comes from Stinging Nettle Botanics, Main Street, Catskill, New York, offering handcrafted organic herb-based products incorporating natural herbal remedies into daily life. StingingNettleNY.com. Yeah, that's it for the show today. Thanks again to Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med for being here. Thank you for listening. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. So many of them today via phone and email. We'll do the topic again. Trust me on that. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Bob Rathbun, who screened the calls. Welcome back, sir. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we'll sit down, we'll shoot the breeze with radio great Bob Cudmore. It'll be two old guys reminiscing about the old days of radio. How can you lose? We'll see you tomorrow at 2.